And now, from Washington, the Inside Scoop. All the news the government does not want you to hear. Now, here's your host on the Inside Scoop, Mark Levine.
Hello, America. Welcome to the Inside Scoop. Well, have you read the headlines? Dick Cheney and Alberto Gonzalez have been indicted. Yay! If only it were meaningful. If you've read those headlines, it's one of those things that's true, but actually quite misleading. There is a renegade prosecutor down in South Texas, one county north of Brownsville, who apparently has been indicted himself and lost his bid for re-election. So he went around and he indicted everybody that was out to get him, and he threw in Dick Cheney and Alberto Gonzalez in the mix. Still, it's kind of one of those things that, you know, you think, if only. Apparently, Dick Cheney was indicted because he owns $65 million in the Vanguard Group, which made me, first of all, pause and say, $65 million? That's just one of his investments? You know, when you think about that, I mean, you know, as a net worth, $65 million is pretty good. But to say, oh, yeah, I got $65 million here and $100 million here and $300, I guess I didn't quite figure out how wealthy he is. Of course, when you direct a policy that aids your old company, Halliburton, to the tune of billions of dollars, the one company that's doing well in this deepening recession, I guess it's understandable why he's doing so well. In any case, Dick Cheney has $65 million in Vanguard Group, which owns a company that owns prisons. And these prisons down in South Texas, they don't really own prisons. Texas, being Texas, has decided that instead of government workers, you know, running prisons, wardens and guards and things like that who can be checked out by federal authorities, they're going to farm that out. You know, private group could do it cheaper than the government. After all, then you don't have to have anyone with any training. You know, just folks who beat the prisoners and, you know, maybe join in with them. Maybe they, you know, get their drugs to the prisoners and from the prisoners and run guns and have a whole lot of good time down there. Anyway, apparently this private group was busy beating up and really grossly mistreating some of the illegal immigrants that came across the border there in South Texas. The county is just a few miles from the Rio Grande. And, Cheney owns stock in the company that owns the company, or stock in a mutual fund that has shares in the company. It's a stretch. Even for me, and I want to get Dick Cheney, it's a stretch. It may be a bit better for Alberto Gonzalez, since he apparently stopped an investigation down there, but these are political things. These aren't criminal things. And it's not like Dick Cheney and Alberto Gonzalez haven't committed criminal acts. It's just that these are the wrong ones. I mean, Alberto Gonzalez, as you must know, was the person who decided, probably he was sent by the president. In fact, at one point he said he was sent by the president, and then there was sort of one of those things where, oh, did I say too much? But he, of course, is the one who went to the very sick Attorney General, John Ashcroft, and tried to convince him to sign an order while he was under drug medication for gallbladder surgery to violate the Constitution and break all kinds of United States laws regarding surveillance. And Attorney General John Ashcroft, who has been kind of squeamish on the Constitution, frankly, wasn't willing to go that far. And even in his drug state, told Alberto Gonzalez to go fly a kite, at which point the deputy attorney general, the head of the FBI, and a whole host of other people threatened to resign, and Alberto Gonzalez backed down. That, to me, is a great crime. And Alberto Gonzalez needs to respond to subpoenas and so forth. He's refused. That, to me, is a great crime. Dick Cheney, of course, has committed a much greater crime. A crime that George Bush Sr. once called the most traitorous of acts that any American can do. Outing a CIA agent. Risking lives, and we may never know, or maybe 25 years before we know how many people were killed, because Dick Cheney decided to out the identity of a CIA agent because he was piqued that her husband, Joe Wilson, told the truth about Bush's lies about Saddam Hussein getting uranium out of Niger. It's a complex story, one we've talked about frequently here. Of course, Scooter Libby was convicted after lying to protect his boss, Dick Cheney, who, it appears, has committed treason. At the very least, there's a dark cloud over the vice president's office, said the Republican special prosecutor, Patrick Fitzgerald. It'll be interesting to see whether we can indict him after he's no longer vice president. So there are very serious crimes that Dick Cheney, Alberto Gonzalez have committed. Unfortunately, when I saw the headline, it looked so wonderful, and it just appears we've got a crazy man. So no, I don't expect anything in Texas to go anywhere. I don't take it seriously. But we have a hope. We have a hope. Meanwhile, the country is falling into a deep, deep recession, and I think it's time to start considering to use the D word, depression. If there is ever any doubt that what's going to come in the next year will be the worst depression since the 1930s, you should have no doubt after today. The stock market hit new lows. It fell dramatically today. It looks like that businesses are having a really hard time getting any credit whatsoever. The prices are falling. Even the price of gasoline, when you think about it, it's about half of what it was 3 months ago. That's just crazy. And it tells you, obviously, that they were price fixing during the summer. If you note, during every summer, the price of gasoline skyrockets because that's when they know people, you know, take trips and vacations and can really get us badly. But they also know if they don't lower it significantly, well, then people are going to move to hybrids. People are going to support energy efficiency. Gosh knows, the oil companies don't want that. You know, one of the great psychological experiments you may have heard about was how to get a rat to push a lever as much as possible. And they found that if the rat pushes the lever and he gets food, then, you know, he eventually pushes it enough, eats enough food, is satiated and stops. If he pushes it every three times and gets food, he knows to push it three times and he gets the food. If he pushes it 10 times to get food, again, after a while, the rat stops pushing. But then they tried a new experiment. They tried a random variable. Sometimes the rat pushes the lever and gets the food right away. Sometimes he must push it 100 times. Sometimes 20. Sometimes 6. And they found that when they varied the amount of times the rat has to push the button to get food, the rat ended up day and night, 24 hours a day, pushing that button. I don't think it's wildly off the mark to say that human beings have similar qualities. When love, for example, is variable, you find a lot of abused people that when they're loved one moment and hated the next and loved one moment and you never know whether you're going to be loved or hated, a lot of times people cling to that dangerous abuse. And so is true of our love of oil, and cars, and gasoline. There's a reason why these prices skyrocket and go down. When they skyrocket, they make billions and tens of billions and hundreds of billions of dollars. ExxonMobil, I repeat, in the midst of this massive recession where the stock market's taking a real tumbling, they are still earning more than any corporation in the world at any time in the history of the world. Yay, ExxonMobil. Good for you. I obviously would tax them heavily. But do you see what they do with the oil prices? Up one day, down the next. It's down now so that we never actually develop hybrids and SUVs and the car companies, which are appealing for the government to save them, won't be pressed so hard to transform into being the new kind of car companies that we have in Japan, Europe, that help protect the environment, help protect the world. But then they go up high when they want to rake in the profits. So up, down, high, low. We're the rat, oil's the food, the oil companies control the levers. And some of us apparently have not risen up on our hind legs to see outside the maze. But the recession is deepening. It's getting worse. It's getting worse all across the board. The economic advisors, these are the neutral ones, not the ones working for Bush, but the, you know, the eggheads in the government, people who do what I was trained to do in college, study economics. I think the unemployment rate will be easily be 8%, the highest level in 25 years. And the worst part is that when the deflation stops, and we're having some deflation now, even if you take apart food and gas, which wildly gyrate, all other prices are actually lower, which is extraordinary. Because when you are in heavy deficit, that leads to very high interest rates as the government's borrowing pushes out other borrowing. And that leads to higher interest rates, which leads to higher inflation. I mean, this is basic economic theory. And yet we have deflation, which suggests that actually the economy is far worse off than even we'd expect. And even when it heals, and I do think it will heal, but even when it heals, we're going to have the stagflation of the 70s. Do you remember the misery index? Some of you aren't old enough to remember the misery index. In Jimmy Carter's time, in the late 1970s, we had high unemployment and high inflation. And Ronald Reagan coined the misery index. You add the two together, and that's how miserable you are. But we have the perfect storm for new misery. As unemployment goes up, as the depression gets worse, the inflation rate, because of the high deficits, because of the massive spending on Iraq and tax cuts for the rich and all the things that George Bush spent on, that's got to go up too. And for Obama to fix it all, and I think he can, and we'll talk about that, we're going to have a period of high unemployment and high inflation. I just thank God that this happened now rather than 6 months from now. Because you know they're going to blame him. You know they're going to blame him. Unemployment will increase throughout the first year of the Obama presidency. At least for the first 6 months, I'm sure. Inflation will go up too, and they're going to blame him. And being a student of history, I couldn't help but restudy the transition of 1933. I mean, prior to Franklin Delano Roosevelt, the Republicans really had a lock on the United States government. After the Civil War, after Abraham Lincoln was president, the new Republican Party, the Republicans from 1860 until 1932 had every single presidency save two, Woodrow Wilson and Grover Cleveland. Let me just go over this in my mind. I'm pretty sure it's true. Was that, you know, Lincoln, Grant, Hayes, who won the disputed election with Tilden? Yeah, Garfield, Arthur, Harrison, McKinley, Roosevelt. Yes, every single presidency, with the exception of two. Grover Cleveland barely won, and Woodrow Wilson won only because the Republican Party was split between Taft and Theodore Roosevelt. Other than these two men, for a period of 72 years, the Republican Party was in control. Think that the Bush era is an era of one-party government? 72 years, again, just two Democratic presidents in the entire 72-year span. That's a long time. So by the time we're coming up to Roosevelt, you see, you know, Herbert Hoover won a landslide in 1928. Calvin Coolidge won a landslide in 1924. The Democratic Party was confined to a few old ex-Confederate southern states. And then comes the Great Depression. The Great Depression. And for all I'm complaining about today's economic situation, let's not forget how great the Great Depression was. We may go up to 8% unemployment. They had 25% unemployment. So I guess we can at least take some solace in the fact that I don't think it's going to be as bad as that. But that's not a very comforting thought. In any case, after Hoover lost in a landslide in 1932, and that's also stunning when you think about it, because the two Democrats that won, Wilson, Cleveland, they barely won. With the exception of the election where Taft and Roosevelt, two Republicans, ran against each other, Cleveland and Wilson barely won. A Democrat hadn't had a landslide since, oh, I don't know, Andrew Jackson. And even he didn't really win the landslide. So when Franklin Delano Roosevelt took power, it was a new day. But he didn't take power until March 4th, 1933. I've talked about this before. At that time, the Constitution had the inauguration change, the transfer of power change, on March 4th of the year. And the idea was 6 months after Election Day. Four months. Can't count. The idea was it'd be 4 months after Election Day because, listen, and, you know, this was done back in the 18th century. It took time to travel, prepare, administration, and so forth. Today, as you know, inauguration begins January 20th because of an amendment passed during the Roosevelt era. But the point is that there were 4 months after Herbert Hoover knew he'd lost the election, after everyone knew that Franklin Roosevelt would be president-elect, after the nation was in an astoundingly horrible Great Depression, and Hoover did his best to get Franklin Roosevelt to help him. Roosevelt said, no, I don't want any part of what you've done. And Hoover decided, much as many Republicans are talking about now, to cut spending. The real problem is big spending. Now, you know, I'm as against big spending as any American. I'm actually a fiscal conservative. During the last decade, during the Bush era, I was far more of a fiscal conservative than the Republicans. But I'm also enough of an economist and a Keynesian, studying John Maynard Keynes, to know that when the nation is in recession, or, dare I say it, depression, it's the worst possible time to balance the budget. And Obama understands this. But I'm already hearing Republicans, like Senator John Cornyn of Texas was saying the other day, well, we've just got to stop the big spending. He really doesn't understand the economy. Yes, it's true the Republicans went on a massive spending spree. Yes, it's true that their big government didn't work. But the reason it didn't work was not because they were spending way beyond our means. That is a problem. It's caused a massive deficit that our children are going to spend a lifetime paying back. It will cause the high interest rates and inflation that are just going to happen in under the first years of the Obama presidency, as they happened in Jimmy Carter's presidency. I'll talk about that in a minute. So it's a real problem. But the reason why the spending didn't stimulate the economy has nothing to do with the level of spending, but where the spending went. See, Republicans pretend that all spending is the same and all taxes are the same. They pretend, or they're just ignorant and believe, that big spending is bad, high taxes are bad, and that's the story. Done. Close it. It depends, though, as any economist will tell you, not on big spending and big taxes, but who is being taxed and where the money's being spent. You see, if you spend a bunch of money on a huge multinational corporation like, say, Halliburton, and ask them to do a bunch of stuff in Iraq, like build weapons that kill people or even build bridges there, it leads to no long-term effect to help the American people. A few Halliburton employees get paid. People who own stock in Halliburton do well. But the mass of Americans are being taxed to spend money that doesn't come back to help them. If, however, the money had been spent in the United States, perhaps making a bridge like I-35 West in Minneapolis, Minnesota strong, or building levees to protect against floodwaters in New Orleans, or helping any of the thousands of decaying roads and bridges and levees and dams and parks and all kinds of public work projects, the exact kind of thing that Franklin Delano Roosevelt did in the 1930s. It helps enormously. First of all, it gives jobs to people here in the United States. You don't have, you know, the $7 billion in, quote, walking around money, unquote, that Prime Minister Maliki of Iraq was asked to hand out and lost. Lost. I don't know if any of you have seen the World Series of Poker. I'm kind of a poker fan, so I watch that kind of thing. And they dump $9 million or so, the grand prize, on a big table. And there's this huge table full of cash. And it's, you know, done for shock value. But what I always think about is that's $9 million. And it fills a whole table. And I'm not talking about neatly stacked. I'm talking about in a huge pile of money, like 3 feet high. And a big table. And that's $9 million. $9 billion is 1,000 of those tables. $9 million at least is conceivable. You have stacks of $100 bills. Each stack is 10,000. You have 100 stacks. That's $1 million. 900 stacks of $100 bills. You can imagine. You see it on the table. I've watched these poker things. But 1,000 of those tables? I mean, I don't think two tractor-trailer trucks can carry it. Let me think. What's it going to take? 10 tractor-trailer trucks? 100 tractor-trailer trucks? And that's the cash we, quote, lost, unquote, in Iraq. That we were taxed to spend on Iraqis that, let's face it, most of them don't want us to be there anyway. And I suspect that most of the Iraqi people didn't get that cash. I suspect it went to a bunch of dictators and not a few terrorists. That, my friends, does not help the American economy. And look at who they taxed, right? They taxed poor middle-class people, the Bush administration. Poor middle-class people took a greater burden of the taxes. Conservatives only talk about income taxes, but we, real Americans, know about Social Security taxes and Medicare taxes. We know about, you know, sales taxes, the taxes that real Americans have to pay every day. And those taxes, those have gone up. Our burden is higher. And the dirty little secret that really shouldn't be a secret is not only that trickle-down economics fails, but that trickle-up economics works. I don't need to repeat, unless you ask me to, my oft-stated metaphor. It's not even a metaphor, it's just an example of the rich car owner and how if you give the money to his employees, everyone's better off. He has to build a new factory, but if you give it all to him, he doesn't need a new factory because there's no demand for his cars. The middle class, poor people need money in their pockets now. So now that I hear John Cornyn, Senator John Cornyn of Texas, say, oh, we have too much big spending, that's exactly wrong. Exactly wrong. He is 180 degrees wrong. We have too little spending on infrastructure, on the middle class, on education, on health care, on the kinds of things that allow the middle class and the lower middle class, and gosh knows, even the poor, that's a word we don't use in politics very much, even the poor, to get a better life. And you know what? There's a nice little side effect. They spend the money, and they roar us out of a recession. So there's too little spending on Main Street. That's the term of art these days in Washington. But there's too much spending still on defense in Halliburton and Iraq and a whole bunch of wasted things. There's too much taxes, yes, on the middle class. We need to cut Social Security taxes. We're building this huge Social Security surplus, and then the government's spending it on Iraq. But there's too few taxes on oil companies, on the super wealthy. Do you remember Al Gore being made fun of on Saturday Night Live for his lockbox? Well, the lockbox. Giggle, giggle, giggle. I wonder how many Americans remember what the lockbox was. It was a metaphor. Perhaps a silly one. But he had a very important idea there. What was the lockbox? That'd be a great trivia question. I would bet that 90% of Americans would fail. What was the lockbox that Al Gore was talking about? The lockbox was a metaphorical construct. It was an idea, but it was a very important one. It was one that said this: if you're being taxed for Social Security, then the money should go to your Social Security. The government should put it there and let it earn interest, but not spend it on Iraq or anything else. Tax cuts to the rich, Halliburton, foreign aid, agricultural subsidies, anything else. It should go to Social Security. The idea was that because Social Security taxes are regressive, they cause the poor to pay more than the rich, a greater percentage of their income, that at the very least the government shouldn't use them to fund other things. Now not only has the Bush administration broken into the lockbox, raided all the funds, used it for Iraq and Halliburton and everything else, but now they're saying, oh, and you're not going to get Social Security anymore unless we raise Social Security taxes. That's like the thief, after robbing your house, saying, oh, I'm sorry, you're going to have to put more in that house so I can take it. You have an empty house now. You need a better house. Put more stuff in it. I have the keys. Al Gore may have been made fun of, but his concept was solid. And if there's anything that needs to be lowered in terms of taxes, it's the Social Security taxes, which are regressive, or at least make everybody pay them. Maybe lower them from 7.5% to 6.5%, but include everybody up to those that make millions of dollars. Let them put the money back in the lockbox. Now, I do think, to President Barack Obama's credit, that he understands these basic economic concepts. But I also know he's in a terrible bind. Jimmy Carter was blamed for the stagflation, the high unemployment, the high inflation of the 1970s. And I am certainly one that can complain about Jimmy Carter's presidency from time to time. I don't think he was as good a president, say, as Bill Clinton. But I also think a lot of it wasn't his fault. Indeed, if I had to give one fault for the cause of the bad economic times under Jimmy Carter, I'd have to say it's from another Democratic president named Lyndon Johnson. Lyndon Johnson, I've talked about this before, was the first president to declare a war and not tax the people to pay for it. Franklin Delano Roosevelt taxed people for World War II, taxed them heavily. The highest tax bracket, it's unimaginable today, was higher than 90% of marginal income. Even I wouldn't support rates that high. I wouldn't. And Korea, taxes paid for that. Civil War, all the wars, taxes paid for. But Lyndon Johnson knew the Vietnam War was unpopular, so he decided that he could have guns and butter. He could spend what he wanted on the war and not raise taxes. And that worked for a while, as it always does. But the chicken does come home to roost. Sorry, Reverend Wright. But it's true, this economic chicken comes home to roost. And the only way to deal with the massive deficits funding a war that's not taxed for is to have 10 years of bad economic times. And I'm afraid that George Bush has put the pox on Barack Obama. So I kind of like that Obama resigned his Senate seat and he's staying away, and let everyone recognize that our next year, because it's not going to be easy, my friends, our next year is entirely the fault of George W. Bush. I'm going to take a break and open the phone lines, 877-4-HEAD-ON, 877-443-2366. I want to know what you think about the deepening recession. Are you doing anything to take care of it? And what do you think about the weird contradiction that if you spend less, it actually helps the recession get worse? Tough thing. Give me a call. We'll be right back after this.
Thinking ahead means preparing for the future. The future of our children, our grandchildren, and our wild, wonderful West Virginia. Developing our renewable energy resources is the best way to ensure a clean, sustainable way of life and safe, good-paying jobs for generations to come. Here in the Mountain State, our most abundant energy resource is the wind. Our ridges and majestic mountain peaks shape and direct the wind like stones in a mountain stream. Coal River Mountain is the ideal place for developing wind power. The Coal River Mountain Wind Farm will provide us with a source of clean energy and good jobs forever. We have the power to make our future happen now. Be a part of the clean energy solution for West Virginia by visiting coalriverwind.org or call 304 854-2182. That's coalriverwind.org, 854-2182.
I'm Matt Rothschild, the editor of the Progressive Magazine, with my Progressive Point of View, which you can also grab off our website over at progressive.org. The Bush administration is essentially detaining another U.S. citizen without trial, this time in the United Arab Emirates. You may not have heard of him, but his name is Naji Hamdan. He was born in Lebanon and then lived for 20 years in L.A., running an auto parts business. In 2006, he and his family moved to the United Arab Emirates, but the FBI has been looking at him for years, and this summer they went to the UAE to question him. A couple weeks later, at the behest of the U.S. government, security agents of the UAE nabbed Hamdan, according to the ACLU, which is suing to gain his release. He's been held now for more than 80 days without charges, and his family's understandably worried since the UAE is known to engage in torture. We need to understand just how creepy this is. The Bush administration didn't have enough evidence to arrest, indict, or try this guy, so they farmed out his imprisonment to the UAE. This is the kind of lawlessness that has become official government practice under Bush-Cheney. That's why it's all the more troubling that Barack Obama has on his own intelligence transition team a George Tenet deputy who supported these policies of disappearance. Obama knows better. This lawlessness has got to stop. I'm Matt Rothschild, and that's how I see it.
We know you want to save big on your phone bill, and we know how you can.
That's right. We do.
We're saving more than 50% on our home phone bill since we switched to CityNet's digital phone plan.
Really? Over 50%?
CityNet's digital phone plan is only $24.95 a month.
Only $24.95?
You get unlimited local and long-distance calling.
Just $24.95.
And with CityNet's digital phone plan, you keep your current number. All you need is a high-speed internet connection. Get details at citynet.net.
$24.95.
And, oh, this is cool. With CityNet's digital plan, I can use my home phone anywhere in the world with high-speed internet. No extra cost.
There's 20, and there's 4, and there's 95.
Did I mention CityNet is a West Virginia-owned company?
Did I mention $24.95?
Save at least 50% on your residential phone. Get unlimited local and long distance and keep your same number, all for just $24.95 a month. Visit citynet.net today for more details. Some exclusions and restrictions may apply.
From Washington, more of the Inside Scoop with Mark Levine.
Welcome back to the Inside Scoop. So what do? We have a deepening recession. We have a new president. We have the Bush administration burrowing its political appointees into the civil service so they can make hell for that new president. You ever had two kids fight over a toy? And they're pushing and they're shoving, and then, you know, mommy makes them take turns. So one kid plays with the toy, makes it spin. The other kid watches jealously as the first child who plays with the toy enjoys his time. Then mommy says, "All right, time to give your brother a turn." So the older boy breaks the toy and hands his little brother the pieces. Welcome to the Bush-Obama transition. Oh, you want to be president? Here you go, crash. You can have it now. Obama has his hands full. And you know, I don't know. Maybe I'm the incurable optimist. I have been accused of so being, and I recognize there are problems with Obama's transition team. Eric Holder, the proposed attorney general, poses some concerns, not just because he failed to stop Bill Clinton from pardoning Mark Rich, but also because he appears to, at least in 2002, been pretty gung-ho about enforcing let's just say, not protecting people's civil liberties. I could say it's understandable. It was 2002. It was right after September 11th. He came around at the end. He was better than any Bush appointee, and that's true, but he bears watching. It's fascinating. I would have preferred to see Hillary Clinton actually as Attorney General than Secretary of State. Because I think it's actually good to have an Attorney General that sort of watches the president. It's scary. It's dangerous. Bill Clinton didn't get his first choice for Attorney General. As you may recall, they had a problem with having not paid taxes on a legal house cleaner. And he got Janet Reno, a woman he hardly knew, but was known for her rectitude. And, Janet Reno kept a close watch. She actually was quite fair for all the incredible abuse that she has undergone from the right and the left. I think Janet Reno tried very hard to do what was right and actually did so. But it's also one of the reasons why Bill Clinton got impeached. If she'd been more of a crony, probably he could have gotten away with a lot more. Presidents do usually appoint their cronies. I mean, John F. Kennedy, for all we praise him, appointed his brother, Robert Kennedy. I like both men, but, you know, when you got your brother as Attorney General, somebody's watching your back and not watching the nation's. And, of course, Alberto Gonzalez was Fredo. George Bush. Bob Kincaid brings up in the chat room Eric Holder's winking at the murders done by the Colombian government in the mess down there. So we need to vet him, and we should vet him. And there's nothing wrong with vetting him. And vetting him does not in any way take, at least for me, from my respect for Obama. The man's not perfect. He's going to make some mistakes. So let's take Eric Holder through the wash. We have a Democratic Congress. I hope they ask him very tough questions. And if he doesn't have good answers, well, Obama maybe should get somebody else. That's the way the process is supposed to work. But we'll see. I just kind of liked Hillary Clinton there because I kind of like the idea of a rival as Attorney General. I mean, I want someone of the same party, of course. But, you know, Attorney General has a lot of power. And most presidents pick someone to watch their back. Famously, Richard Nixon, when the Attorney General allowed an investigation to Watergate, fired him. And then came number two. He insisted the investigation continue, fired him too, and then came Robert Bork, number three, who famously stopped the investigation into Watergate, followed Nixon's orders after the so-called Saturday Night Massacre, and fired the prosecutor. Didn't stop Watergate. But so I've got my concerns, but I think overall he's building up nicely. I think Tom Daschle will be a very good Secretary of Health and Human Services. I am concerned about the Bush administration and all the politicos they're putting in civil service jobs. I wonder how many people at Justice were hired because of Monica Goodling, that very young graduate of the worst law school in the United States, Pat Robertson High or whatever it was called, Jerry Falwell, I don't know, I don't care. Jerry's Law School, you know, where they teach that, you know, dinosaurs and mankind roamed at the same time and whatever. I wonder how many people she put in the Justice Department. And it's going to be hard to clean them out. But we have to. Because people serving justice shouldn't have a political agenda. It's one thing to have the people at the top. They should. Civil servants are supposed to simply go through and do the business of the day and indict people when they're supposed to be indicted, not politically. So, sorry, down in South Texas, not Cheney Gonzalez, at least not for those things, and definitely not to Don Siegelman of Alabama or any of the others that Karl Rove tried to put in jail. It's going to take time. It's going to be hard to clean them out, but it's something that has to be done. So, we'll see. We'll see where Obama's going. There's still some time. I do want to invite you again to call in your thoughts on any of this. 877-4HEAD-ON, 877-443-2366. In other news, the United Nations has confirmed that Syria did have a nuclear plant. It looks very likely. They actually found uranium in the dirt of the plant that Israel bombed. Syria had done a tremendous job of trying to bring in new dirt, to get rid of everything, to mix it all up, to put it on. But what do you know? The IAEA did its job, the International Atomic Energy Agency, and actually found the nuclear remains. Which says to me a couple things. It says to me that, first of all, George Bush was wrong, fancy that, in saying that the IAEA was just a bunch of United Nations hacks and they couldn't find nuclear material if it was right in front of their nose. They can, and they did. And they're willing to find it, and they are a competent agency. And the fact that they couldn't find weapons of mass destruction in Iraq prior to our invasion is because there wasn't any. Ding, 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 ding. So, it also says to those who are skeptical that some terrorists in the Middle East, some dictators, heads of countries, are seeking nuclear weapons. For those who are skeptical that Syria was seeking nuclear weapons, look, lo and behold, the IAEA found the evidence. Good for them. Which shows you, in general, whether it's Iraq or Syria or Iran or anyone else, North Korea, inspections are valuable things. And they're a heck of a lot cheaper than war. A heck of a lot cheaper than war. In fact, rarely does anyone die in inspections. They may cost $1 million instead of $1 trillion. But in any case, as many of you know, I am glad that Israel bombed that Syrian plant, and I'm also glad it didn't lead to any wider war. It was a very limited attack. It caused no deaths. It stopped a dangerous dictator from getting nuclear power. Kudos to Israel on that. I don't know that they can do the same thing in Iran. I hope they won't have to try. Israel, of course, is involved in its own political race. Its current Prime Minister, Olmert, has been involved in another scandal. It seems like every other Israeli Prime Minister is involved in some kind of scandal. He's stepping down. And the battle is between, it's actually a three-way battle, but the Labor Party, which is on the sort of the left end, probably won't prevail. It's really down to the Kadima Party, the centrist party, Tzipi Livni, who would be the second woman to be Prime Minister of Israel. She is from Olmert's party. And Benjamin Netanyahu from the right, from the Likud. And it's a very close race, and it's a very interesting race. Benjamin Netanyahu has taken a page out of Obama's playbook and actually copied the Obama website, changing the name from Obama to Netanyahu. The New York Times has a famous picture of the two websites, and lo and behold, there's Netanyahu's page. Bright blue, which is Israel's color. It's also the Obama colors, you know, the dark blue and the light blue, and pretty much the boxes look alike. What do they say? Flattery is imitation is the sincerest form of flattery. It's going to be a close race. And I think it's, I don't know which way it will go. A lot of people, a lot of Israelis are thinking that the negotiations haven't gotten them anywhere. There seems to be a growing war with Hamas. And that can lead to one of two directions. Either a defensive posture with Netanyahu saying this isn't working, we give up. Or a more open posture with Livni saying we just have to redouble our efforts. It'll be interesting to see which new Prime Minister Barack Obama greets when he becomes president. Elsewhere in the world, people are still excited about Barack Obama. They are all over the world, not just in Kenya, but recognizing, I think, that America has redeemed itself a bit. We are no longer the cowboy nation. The idea that, yes, America can put an African-American in power. Let's just leave out the fact that he's half white. That's not as good a story, and frankly, it's not something that the Europeans or the Africans or the Asians are focusing on. But I think it is making America already, before Obama even takes power, getting a bit more respect in the world. I think the Europeans understand that it's very unlikely that they would put a non-European in power. Very unlikely. Even though they are far to the left of us on a number of issues. And in Africa, of course, Suddenly they see the United States perhaps as a friend rather than an enemy. I thought it was fascinating that Al-Qaeda put out a video that called Obama the House Negro. Did you hear this? They said that Malcolm X was the good black man murdered by the man, who, of course, was Muslim. But Obama was born of a Muslim father, prays to the Jews, and claims to be Christian. Of course, anyone that knows Obama's story knows he hardly knew his father, and his father was atheist, though from a Muslim family. But that's not the point. The point is Al-Qaeda is trying to get the third world to join in the fight against the United States, something that, let's face it, just 3 months ago was something they could do. Most of the world was angry at the United States, saw us as a cowboy nation, saw us as a racist, imperialist nation. I think Al-Qaeda's video went over like a lead balloon. Al-Qaeda itself is a racist organization. They worked very closely with the Arab government of Sudan because they gave them, you know, solace and a place to train their terrorist camps. They gave them a haven. The government of Sudan, of course, is the one involved in genocide against the Africans of Sudan. See, Sudan is a majority Arab, minority African population. They both live there. It's one of the few, in fact, countries in Africa that spans the difference between the Arab North and the Black South. The Sahara Desert is a natural boundary, but Sudan has the Nile River flowing down between it, so it's one of the few places where Arabs and Africans intermix. But the Arabs have always been firmly in charge. They've always treated the Africans as second-class citizens, and now they're murdering them. Hundreds of thousands daily, and maybe over a million by now. In Darfur. We all know about Darfur. I've done shows on it. Other people have talked about it. It's an ongoing genocide that everyone seems to be ignoring. Well, not only have U.S. policymakers largely ignored Darfur, Al-Qaeda ignores it too. You'll be glad to know. While they talk about standing up for the third world, they're not about to stand up for the rights of Africans to live in peace along with Arabs. So it's nice to know that our enemies don't know what they're doing either. As I said, though, Obama does have a lot on his hands. I'll give you one last chance to call in. We got about 10 minutes. I'd like to hear from you if you got any views on anything I've said today. 877-4-HEAD-ON, 877-443-2366. In the meantime, let's talk about General Motors, Chrysler, Ford, the big three. And the corporate executives that came to Washington this week, hat in hand, tin cup out. And how did they get here? They took their corporate jets. Ooh, not the right symbol. I like to think they even regret it. But somehow I doubt it. Congressman Brad Sherman, Democrat of California, asked them to raise their hands if they flew here commercial. They sat still. He asked them to raise their hands if they flew here first class. They sat still. He asked them if they're going to plan to sell their corporate jets and use commercial airlines in the future. They all sat on their hands. Don't you hate it when you mix the good and the bad? I mean, you got these car execs. It's, you know, sometimes it's hard to tell the difference. You have these, the big three, and they're holding the workers hostage. They kind of remind me of terrorists. You know, the terrorists that go in and they make demands, and they've got their guns at innocent men, women, and children. And they say, you know, do what I say, and I'll let the hostage live. Don't do it, and you may kill me, but I'll kill the hostages. That's exactly what the CEOs of the big three are saying. Oh, you don't like me? You don't like I'm the corporate jet? Fine. Don't help me. I'll make sure that hundreds of thousands of American workers suffer. They'll lose their health care. They'll lose their jobs. Car parts manufacturers, dealerships across the nation. Oh, you want to hurt me? I've got lots of hostages. Don't ask me to get rid of my corporate jet. And you're in a bind. You're in a pickle. What do you do as a policymaker? You do want to help, as I want to help, as you want to help. The guy in the assembly line. The woman selling cars in the lot. The people at the car parts place. It's not their fault. They can't help but that Detroit didn't go hybrid when they should. It wasn't their decision not to build the smaller cars that go faster with lighter metal. It's not their fault. It's the fault of the men that refused to take the commercial jets. The ones that made hundreds of millions of dollars as they ran their companies into the ground. What do you do? Well, if we had a free market, if we had capitalism in America, if we had a system that worked and punished the people who made bad business decisions, the way Adam Smith in Wealth of Nations said it would happen, you know who he is? He wrote The Wealth of Nations in 1776. He talked about the invisible hand of the free market and how it is that invisibly everyone does what's in their best interest, and lo and behold, it makes it everyone else's best interest. And Adam Smith, in small economic examples, is right. You know, if you're driving on a highway and the right lane is all crowded, you move to the left lanes, which are empty. And by doing so, you actually decrease the congestion in the right lane. That's a free market at work. And yes, if you own a lemonade stand and you charge $20 for each glass, you're not likely to get any business. If you charge a penny, you're likely to get too much, and so you charge the proper middle point. I'm not someone who doesn't believe in free markets. I'm someone that understands the limit of the free market. How would the free market work if we had a free market with regard to car companies? I'll tell you how it would work. Shareholders, prices of their shares are going through the toilet, and they're likely to go bankrupt, would meet together in something called a shareholders meeting and vote out these bastards who are running the company and vote in someone who cared about the financial health of the company and, in caring about the financial health of the company, would care about the long-term expert workers, well-trained, unionized workers who did such a good job. That's how it would work, and there would be no need for government intervention. In fact, that's even how textbooks say it happens. Textbooks. What do they know? Why don't they tell us the truth? The truth is shareholders don't own the corporation. Oh, no, don't say that on your exams, those of you in college. If you say it on your exams, you'll fail, because technically the shareholders do own the corporations. In the same way that technically I and all the rest of you Americans own every inch of federal parkland and military bases, right? Right? I mean, look at Guantanamo Bay. I own that. So do you. It's leased by the United States of America. We're all Americans. We own Guantanamo Bay. But we don't have much control over what happens there. Actually, that may be a bad example. We voted for a president, Barack Obama, who's going to dismantle Guantanamo Bay. But the point is that shareholders don't have even less power over their companies than we have over our country, than we have over Abu Ghraib or Yellowstone National Park, just because we all own it as American citizens. And the reason is simple. Unlike in America, where we have contested elections, corporations don't. And they don't because they are chartered by various states. They tend to go to Delaware. Why do they go to Delaware? Because Delaware is a tiny state that realized that if it gave really, really favorable laws to management of corporations, they would choose to incorporate there. And Delaware, a tiny state, could make a lot of money from the incorporation fees, which matters in a tiny state, and by doing so would harm all the other 50 states. Sorry, Joe Biden, I like you very much, but I don't like your state. And I don't like what your state does to rate, make every American corporation descend to the worst possible level. Delaware law says that if you want to challenge the management of a corporation, you can't just run somebody up there. No, 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 no. You have to do a proxy fight, and that costs millions of dollars. And the company can use millions of dollars from the same shareholders who are angry, right, at the corporation to try to stop them. You understand? You got a company, let's say it's called General Motors, that's being run into the ground, let's say because the executives refuse to compete with Japan and Europe by doing smaller, more energy-efficient cars. And they make bad business decisions, and they make hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars, and the company's run into the toilet. Let's just say. So the shareholders decide to appoint, oh, I don't know, Mark Levine, to come in there to run the company better. Does Mark Levine get to get just as a shareholder petition and nominate Mark Levine and his name gets in the election? No, 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 no. That would be democratic. That's the way unions do it. No, 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 no. That's not the way corporate management does it. Mark Levine would have to spend, oh, I don't know, $50, $100 million, probably more, in a massive proxy fight to send letters to every shareholder to say why he wants to be on the ballot. And then the company that's bleeding cash, the company that's going bankrupt, could then take hundreds of millions from these same shareholders that are losing their shirt, grab more money from them, make the shares decrease in price, all in a way to keep Mark Levine off the ballot. That is not democracy. That indeed is the way a number of tin-pot dictatorships rule. Exactly the same way. So, you know what? I'm okay with the free market. As long as it's free. As long as shareholders can remove bad managers. And this is one of the things that my ex-boss, Congressman Barney Frank, is working toward. He tried to get a bill. It's amazing. These tiny steps that he tried. He tried to get a bill that would simply allow the shareholders to vote to express disapproval of their manager. Not vote them out. No, that would be true democracy. Simply allow them to vote to say they don't like the guy and think they need new management. And to allow every corporation to have that vote, whether the manager likes it or not. And that non-binding resolution, it would be binding in government. It would be non-binding in the corporation. In other words, the shareholders could say, I don't like this guy, but he'd stay in power. The Republicans filibustered it. They wouldn't allow it to happen. It's a tiny step. But it's a start. It's a start. Because I'm sick and tired of these executives coming in, holding their workers hostage, and everyone saying there's nothing we can do about it. I understand why we had the $700 billion bailout bill for the financial industry, but I don't want to see anyone in the financial industry profiting from it. They all need to be fired. And the only way they're ever going to be fired is to rework the system so that we actually have a free market, lo and behold, a democracy, where the people in charge, the owners of the business, the shareholders, actually get a chance to vote the bastards out. When that kind of financial restructuring occurs, we'll finally be on a sound stage to moving our way out of the second Great Depression. Hope you enjoyed the show. If you want to comment on anything we've said, you know what to do. Go to RadioInsideScoop.com. Post your comments there. Next up, your hillbilly elitist, Bob Kincaid. This is Mark Levine, signing off.